ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। टुडे वी आर रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम कैंटो 10 चैप्टर 14 चैप्टर एंटाइटल्ड ब्रह्मास प्रेयर्स टू लॉर्ड कृष्णा टेक्स्ट 30-35। सो टेक्स्ट 30 प्लीज रिपीट आफ्टर मी। तदस्तु मे नाथ स भूरि भागो भवेत्र वान्यत्र तव तिरस्कम्। येनाहम् एकोऽपि भवज्जनानां भूत्वा निषेवे तव पादपल्लवम्। ट्रांसलेशन। माय डियर लॉर्ड, आई देयरफॉर प्रे टू बी सो फॉर्चुनेट दैट इन दिस लाइफ एज लॉर्ड ब्रह्मा और इन अनदर लाइफ wherever I take my birth, I may be counted as one of your devotees. I pray that wherever I may be, even among the animal species, I can engage in devotional service to your lotus feet. There's no purport. Text 31, translation. O Almighty Lord, how greatly fortunate are the cows and bodies of Vrindavan. O Almighty Lord, how greatly fortunate are the cows and ladies of Vrindavan, the nectar of whose breast milk you have happily drunk to your full satisfaction, taking the form of their calves and children. All the Vedic sacrifices performed from time immemorial up to the present day have not given you as much satisfaction. No purport, text 32, translation. How greatly fortunate are Nanda Maharaj, the cowherd men, and all the other inhabitants of Rajbhumi. There is no limit to their good fortune because the absolute truth, the source of transcendental bliss, the eternal supreme Brahman has become their friend. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. This translation is quoted from Srila Prabhupada's Chaitanya Charitamrit, Madhya Leela, Chapter 6, Text 149. Text 33, translation. Yet even though the extent of the good fortune of these residents of Vrindavan is inconceivable, we 11 presiding deities of the various senses, headed by Lord Shiva, are also most fortunate because the senses of these devotees of Vrindavan are the cups through which we repeatedly drink the nectarian intoxicating beverage of the honey of your lotus feet. No purport. Text 34. Translation. My greatest possible good fortune would be to take any birth whatever in this forest of Gokul and have my head bathed by the dust falling from the lotus feet of any of its residents. Their entire life and soul is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mukunda, the dust of whose lotus feet is still being searched for in the Vedic mantras. Purport. This verse indicates that Lord Brahma desires to take birth even as the smallest blade of grass in Vrindavan, so that the holy residents of the Lord's abode may walk upon his head and bless him with the dust of their feet. Being realistic, Lord Brahma does not aspire to directly achieve the dust of Lord Krishna's feet. Rather, he aspires for the mercy of the Lord's devotees. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that Brahma is willing to take birth even as a stone in a paved footpath in the Lord's abode. Since Brahma is the creator of the entire universe, we can just imagine the glorious position of the residents of Vrindavan. The Lord's devotees achieve their exalted position by unalloyed devotion and love. One cannot achieve such spiritual opulence by any puffed up material process of personal improvement. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada reveals the mind of Brahma as follows, quote, "But if I am not so fortunate as to take birth within the forest of Vrindavan, I beg to be allowed to take birth outside the immediate area of Vrindavan, so that when the devotees go out, they will walk over me. Even that would be a great fortune for me. I am just aspiring for a birth in which I will be smeared by the dust of the devotees' feet." Unquote. So in the continuing prayers of Lord Brahma, we see the most exalted and the most powerful personality of the material world, the creator of the material world, really, taking the position of the lowest of all. When he says that he is willing to, he would be very happy, gladly take the, even the animal species, to so that the devotees of Vrindavan can walk on his head. So the message that we get, you know, we hear Krishna conscious philosophy over several years, and if you see, the message is the same, essentially, in essence is the same, that we are not this body, we are looking for the mercy of the Lord so that we can find a guru, and in the mercy of the guru will take us to the Lord, and in that process what attracts that mercy will be the attitude of how we develop this kind of consciousness, the consciousness which is exactly exemplified by Lord Brahma, namely that and he genuinely feels that his position is completely insignificant, even though we cannot even conceive, imagine what Lord Brahma's position is, having created all the universes and all the living species. So this is the attraction that he has for his father, his eternal father. And that in that consciousness, we try to understand how we can also move towards that, on that path. And here Lord Brahma is continually praising and glorifying the devotees of Vrindavan. Actually, we see that in the Bhagavad Gita, we do know that the main message in the Bhagavad Gita at the end, when Krishna gives the final conclusion really to Arjuna, sarva dharman parityaja mam ekam sharanam braja, at that time Prabhupada translates the word braja as go. Now this go is a concealed prefix for gopa or gopi, because they are the highest embodiment of surrender, for which is the conclusion of the at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. And when Krishna spoke to Arjun, he was so confused. We know that when in the beginning his position was completely bewildering, and he actually purposely takes that role. Arjun's role is perfectly enacted. It's really like a drama for all times to come, in such a way that the pure devotee takes that position where Arjun is cast in that role of somebody who's completely perplexed, you know, totally lost he's come to the end of his own thinking process. And why is that? Because, you know, we know that he has, in the beginning he puts a lot of logical arguments about why he should not fight, because Bhagavad Gita is spoken on the battlefield. But then at the end of all his initial arguments, he's completely bewildered and confused. And Prabhupada says repeatedly in many purports that this is actually the state of our bewilderment, the perplexities that nobody, in fact, whether somebody is a president of the country or whether is a scholar or whatever the situation, everybody gets completely perplexed, you know, bewildered by various things that happen in life, day to day practically. So Arjun, at the end of this, his confusion, and then when he turns to Krishna and says that, I'm completely lost. And why he's feeling that? Because he's seeing that people whom he has dearly loved and respected, people who mean the most to him in his life, are actually going to fight against each other. And he's obviously going to fight on one side. And he's going to see people, the dearmost people that he holds closest to his heart, are going to, many of them will certainly die. And worst of all, he would be the cause of, the immediate cause of their death, because he would be the main aggressor actually, the key person, he knew his responsibility and his strength. And in his so-called moral stand, you know, that was a dilemma of the highest order. He just couldn't move, he didn't know what he should do. And that, at the end, when he is completely lost, this is actually the beginning of spiritual life, as far as Srila Prabhupada has explained to us, that when we are lost or when we are confused, and actually we see that in most cases devotees have come when they are at the end of their own wits, when they've had a setback, when we had. So whatever Krishna arranges in our life, we can see eventually that it is perfectly arranged such that the path is clear for any sensible person to take the lifeline that is sent to him. So at that, so at the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita is the is a surrender, which is actually the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam, we know, is the nectarian description of the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, of Lord Krishna, directly, particularly Lord Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. And as far as the Bhagavatam is concerned, we know it was written also by Vedvyas, because Vedvyas actually had written so many, he was the author of practically all the scriptures that we know, from the Vedas, all the four Vedas and the Upanishads, the Itihas, the Puranas. But because he was still having some dissatisfaction, his Guru Maharaj Narad Muni told him that the reason for it is that we have not described the key essence of life, which is the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, and therefore you should write a book, about Krishna. And that's when Vedvyas writes. So the message that Lord Vedvyas actually gives in the Bhagavatam is actually from the beginning. We have the stories of the Pandavas and then about Parikshit Maharaj and Sukhdev Goswami, and about Prahlad Maharaj, Dhruv Maharaj, Amrish Maharaj. In every case, we see that there is a continuous a link of which binds all these stories, is ultimately the surrender to Krishna. And in almost all the cases, the prayers also have the same essence. But yet it is unique and, you know, highly personal, but the content is the same. So it is really urging anyone who follows the path to, at least on a mental level, there can be no doubts about what the goal is and how and why we should be surrendering. Then the next step is through the association, how we can, and through our sadhana, we can come closer to making it an internal process and a daily process, and then eventually a moment-to-moment process. So in this process of all these stories, finally the culmination comes in the 10th canto of the Bhagavatam, which is really the essence of what Sri Vedvyas is writing about, the transcendental pastimes of the Lord, of Krishna, from his infancy, from his birth really, to all stages of his life. But and that is where, when we talk of Lord Brahma's glorification of the gopis and the gopas, the residents of Vrindavan, it is primarily because of that in this description in the Bhagavatam of the 10th canto, which we are actually also going through now, the essences of the highest level of surrender is exemplified by the gopis, because they surrendered everything. They had, in fact, when they were repeatedly tested by Krishna, very often Krishna would, for instance, on Sharad Purnima night, when he played the flute, all the gopis left everything. They left their security, their reputation, their homes, their wealth, their families. So practically there was no turning back for them, because they had, as they say, burnt the bridges. And in that situation they came to Krishna, and then Krishna actually tested them by saying that, you have come to me, but now you should go back. It's late in the night and you have your duties at home. And then the gopis actually convinced Krishna that actually now you know that they made very nice arguments which convinced Krishna that you are the goal of all surrender, you are the goal of all love, of everything that is there to love, and you are the center of everything. Then Krishna performs the Ras Leela, and then the gopis are so this is where the gopis are completely are considered at the highest levels, where they, and it was not just an incident to incident, it was the residents of Vrindavan, for them their relationship was above surrender actually, because they never looked at Krishna as someone whom they had to surrender, it was even beyond the friendship or beyond the, it was an intimacy of a level which it is unfathomable for neophyte devotees like us. But the conclusion is that they loved Krishna as a person such that they were willing to do anything and everything for him. I mean, they were completely willing to give up their lives. We know there are so many stories about how, when Krishna had a headache, and then the gopis, within a second, without even thinking, they just when they were told as a test again that you need to take the dust, you have to give the dust of your feet on to put on his head, knowing that they will go to, they may go to hell for millions of years because of the aparadh, still they were willing to. They didn't care for that, because their only concern was, so every focus was only how they could please Krishna. So this is really the goal, the final conclusion of the highest surrender. Therefore, when anyone measures up to whether we are surrendering enough or where we are, we can see that there is a lot, we cannot reach that levels. But we do know that the highest devotees, the greatest sadhus, they have actually reached that level, and therefore anything that we may consider as on the path of surrender, there is much more to be done than what we have done at any time of life. So in this process of surrender, the gopis are considered to be the highest. Also, Lord Brahma is expressing his deep appreciation. So this desire to glorify, the desire to appreciate Vaishnavas and devotees is very, very important. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu actually constantly, one of the reasons why Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would always chant the holy names and attract everyone, the millions of people who were following him. He brought this process just that the purification of the heart by chanting the holy names would gradually bring us to the level, would at least start eliminating the aparadhas and the anarthas, such that we come to a level where we only see the good of others. And that is again exemplified in so many ways by so many acharyas and great devotees, where they saw only the best of everything. They never saw any fault in anyone. Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami, the author of Chaitanya Charitamrita, he says that I take the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees and I put them on my head and I worship them with all humility. So this is his prayer. And who was given the task of actually writing the pastimes of Lord Chaitanya for all times to come. And when he says this, that again sets the gold standard of humility, of how the surrender and how the appreciation of devotees, that even the smallest spark in everything, in any devotee, could be brought up. So, in this process of appreciating and glorifying the devotees, it is a process which is actually starting by our own purification. Because actually, our consciousness is what really stops us from seeing the good in others. And our consciousness is, or lack of proper consciousness is what really makes us see the faults in others. This is the thing. So it is us, we have to change ourselves. It is our mind, and the mind is conditioned by our intelligence, or controlled by intelligence. And that's in the story of the Avanti Brahman in the 11th canto. And when he was such an obnoxious person, and he was therefore perhaps justifiably treated in the worst ways, or maybe not justifiably, but at least he got what was his due by all the members of the family and society, because when they got a chance, and then he was absolutely flat, you know, he was in the worst state imaginable, completely deserted by all. Every person, everybody had lost, given up on him, and also were mistreating him now, and they were taking their acts of vengeance. Even the local boys and everybody would, humiliate him for all that he had done. And his family abandoned him, he had no money, nothing. He was completely penniless. And then, by Krishna's mercy, he got the real understanding that actually, that I have no enemy. My only enemy is my mind. That actually, I see this person as my enemy, as my friend. And so that consciousness is really, which is actually affecting our vision. And to purify the consciousness, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu brought this wonderful process of the chanting of the holy name, both as our silent, our own personal japa, as well as the congregation chanting. And particularly the congregation chanting was not only for the benefits of all those who participate, but for all those who even heard. And in that process, there's a very nice story actually, to know how powerful the holy name is. The Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was once, when he was dancing on the streets, going to Vrindavan, and he was, as usual, he was attracting hundreds and thousands of devotees. And wherever he went, you know, because it was magic. People would just get attracted to him. Whoever came to him would come, would just start chanting. They would also start reciting the Mahamantra and dancing on the streets with their arms raised. Also, they started worshipping him. They wanted to take the dust from his lotus feet. So there were so many thousands and thousands of devotees who were taking the dust, that actually they were taking the dust from his feet while he was dancing. So then holes on the road, the little holes and big holes started appearing on the road, because there was so much dust was taken. So there were so many people who were, that just gives an idea of how many millions of people literally were taking the dust. But he was in a completely different world. Whenever Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in Sankirtan, nothing and nobody, you know, mattered to him. He was completely oblivious of that. So he was carrying on, and millions of people were following him literally. And then eventually he actually entered Ramkeli, which is in Bengal. And at that time he was the king, the Nawab Hussain Shah, was a tyrant. He was actually against Hindus to such an extent that anybody who even spoke or any act or any Hindu religious act would not only be condemned, but he could be beaten up and perhaps even killed. So it was a very dangerous place actually. But Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the Lord Chaitanya, continued. And as he was dancing on the streets, amazingly, more and more devotees came, more and more people, common people also came forward. Even hundreds of Muslims started joining in the dancing. They were so attracted by, you know, by his form, and also by the holy name itself. And then the word went to Nawab Hussain Shah, and then there was a policeman who actually came and gave a wonderful description. It just came out of his heart, is pouring out from as a torrent to the Nawab, you know, saying that, what I've seen now, I cannot imagine, I cannot even explain to you that here is this personality who's much taller than most, long arms, and he gives a description of every part of his body, you know, that such beautiful lotus-like eyes, and his in a very aristocratic nose, his features are the most beautiful I've ever seen, you know, with red lips and his pearl-like teeth, and his shoulders are so broad, and he's walking like an elephant. And also his activities are completely inexplicable, you know, because he sometimes he roars like thousands of lions, and then he goes into a trance. He does not eating or sleeping for days, in fact. And his body is so soft, but then when he jumps so high, it goes abnormally high in the sky, and then yet when he falls, he crushes all the boulders and the rocks, and he has and there's no harm to him. So I have seen many sadhus, I've seen many religious persons of different faiths, but I have never seen anyone like this. So like that, he describes in very great detail. Just by hearing about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and about his holy name, and he also mentioned that millions of people are following, including Muslims who are dancing on the streets, everything this policeman started telling. Just by hearing this, the Nawab Hussain Shah was, his heart became very soft, just by hearing. He had never met Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he was astonished, he was absolutely struck with wonder what he heard. He didn't, but see, somehow, in spite of such a despot, you know, such a tyrant that he was, yet when it came to when Sama Krishna gave him that, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy was such that he actually heard with rapt attention. And so when he heard everything that this policeman said, his heart melted. And he said that, no, this, oh, this is wonderful. So he should do whatever he can. We are very blessed that he's come to our place. And anyone who stops him, whether he's a Qazi or whether he's a policeman or whoever, you know, I will personally kill him. Nobody should ever obstruct him, and this is a law. He became completely ecstatic by doing this. So, but first he wanted to, I missed out one thing. He wanted to verify this. So he called one of his ministers, Keshav Khan, and he asked him to, whether this is true, you know, what he heard from the policeman. Now, Keshav Khan was a very saintly person, and he actually knew the glories of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and but he was secretly afraid that he says, today this king is now, suddenly he's hearing something, so he's very happy. But tomorrow he may hear something negative and he may change his mind and he'll start to send his soldiers and attack Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he wanted to downplay, you know, just with good intentions. He said, no, this is not true. It is actually wrong facts you've got. And he's an ordinary, he's a beggar. He's just, he has nobody. He is just on the streets and nobody supporting him. Or maybe a few people are with him. But basically he's a poor beggar. This Nawab became so angry, you know, on the basis of just hearing what he had heard. He said, how can you say this? He is a poor beggar. Do you know, he's a supreme personality of Godhead. He is, they call him Krishna. He's the same as what the Quran says is Allah. And he's come to bless our homeland. And you call him a poor. In fact, I have a small kingdom, but he has the whole kingdom. All this belongs to him, so he has the entire kingdom. So, and you call him a poor beggar, you know, this is an aparad. And this is the change that took place in this mind of just by hearing about the Lord. And he went on and on. So, many people were happy, but again, some of the devotees and Brahmins were very scared that this, again, you know, today, because they had seen the kind of, you know, tyrannical, you know, reign of the Nawab. It was said that he was so cruel and so hated that actually, if the wind touched him and then touched any people on the street, they would actually run to the Ganges and have a bath. That was the kind of fear and terror and hatred they had towards him. So now suddenly seeing him in a new light, First of all, that credibility gap was there a little bit. They're not sure that whether he's changed for real or not. So the Brahmins were, the devotees were also scared. So what they wrote a message and asking, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was staying very near the kingdom. You know, he had come right up to the courts when he was taking the Harinam. So he sent a message, the Brahmins, the devotees sent a message saying that to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he was right in the middle of the kirtan, they couldn't approach him. So they said, when he ends the kirtan, we'll give him the message, that why are you staying so close to the, in a village which is so close, you know, you should go away, because there is danger still, you know, there could be danger in future, because he is whimsical. And when he mentioned this, so the letter was given to a pious Brahmin to give it to the Lord when he finishes his kirtan. So the Brahmin went and paid his obeisances, and then he was waiting. But the kirtan went on and on. You know, it went on right through the day, and then it went into the night, went through the night, then the next whole day, then the next night, and the next day. So the Brahmin was waiting, saying that, how am I going to approach him? Because there is no way, you know, when Lord Chaitanya is in such a mood, when he's in kirtan, not even his intimate associates speak to him. Means he doesn't speak to anyone. He's in a completely different trance. So there's no question of him speaking to the Brahmin. So the Brahmin waited for quite a few days, and after that he had to go. So he gave the message to his intimate devotees of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and left. And then eventually the Lord sensed that there was fear in the hearts of the devotees around him. So he stopped and he said, he asked, what is the problem? And then they mentioned that this is the case, that he's, they're all worried about your staying nearby. So the Lord said, what is the fear? Why are they worried? If I don't give the power to him for the Nawab to walk, he will not be able to walk. If I don't give him the power to speak, his tongue will not move. There's nothing to fear. So eventually Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, of course, completely pacified them. But this, the story illustrates the power of the holy name and the power of the presence of the Lord, both personally and through the holy name, such that actually a transformation of one of the most hated personalities and the most powerful personalities took place without even seeing, without he even hearing the Maha Mantra. Just hearing about the Maha Mantra and about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there was such a transformation that this person was started singing to the glories, and he started counteracting any argument against it. Even somebody who was testing him, he came vehemently down and in support, and that was the kind of change that brought about him. So we can see that the spreading of the holy name. Now if you come to what is that we can do, and I thought that we could just link this to, if you take the essence of what Lord Brahma is saying about how he is glorifying and appreciating the highest devotees of the Lord, and through that how Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, because he spread the holy name especially for the Kali Yuga, through that we can see Srila Prabhupada in that light. How dear Srila Prabhupada must be, how close and how intimate he would be with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and his followers, because in the line of disciplic succession, he has been doing exactly that. That it was like passing the baton, and then it was destined by the Lord that in the 20th century, 19 centuries of Kali Yuga would go, and the 20th century, somebody takes up this and goes to the world. It's a historical perspective, and then he goes across the seas and does exactly what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu started and what all the Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya is propagating, that bringing the holy name of the Lord to every town and village as per the prediction of the Lord. So I was just thinking that in what way we can, if we talk about Srila Prabhupada, we can speak for days, and there are and still it would not be sufficient. But just one aspect which I thought would be interesting and also very heartwarming, that if you were to talk about his, you see, every Srila Prabhupada was in the disciplic succession, which is what we appreciate. And therefore, he always said, I am a postman and I am only just following what, delivering the message as given to me by my guru and who was given by his guru. And I am giving it, my only qualification is I am giving it to you exactly as it is. I am not making any change. At the same time, simultaneously, Srila Prabhupada has his own stamp. And Rupa Goswami actually explains that a guru, you know, in the looking to the time, place, and circumstance, an acharya in the disciplic succession would is authorized and would make the changes, and those changes are called details. And so it is not the philosophy, but it is the specific instances which can further the cause of spreading the holy name and bringing everyone closer to Krishna, to develop love of Krishna. So what are the things which Srila Prabhupada really, which you can say were his stamp, you know, it was unique, where he, because we tend to take for granted actually, and there are many, but I just would think of some, that first of all, he talked about, before him, Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj and the other acharyas were chanting 64 rounds. He was the one who, looking to the situation, the audience that he was chanting, they practically fainted when he told them they had to chant 64 rounds. So he then brought it down to 16 rounds, but he said 16 minimum. So that was something which he took it upon himself. You know, it was a concession, but he saw that that would be sufficient, say 2 hours of in the day, which would then be then help the devotees, and if they can gradually improve the quality of the chanting. Then the introduction of the Rath Yatra, which was again unique. In his own experience as a child, you know, he was very much attracted by it. But his genius, you can say, was that when he brought it to the Western audience, it was a perfect fit, because as Satswarup Maharaj also writes in his book, that the Western audience was just ready for it, because they like parades, they like festivals, you know, they like all this dancing and on the streets. And Prabhupada externally brought this attraction to them, but also they got the blessings of the Lord, of Lord Jagannath, not only for themselves, but also for everyone who saw it. Lord Jagannath, so merciful. So this was was very unique. Then, of course, his constant push for books, distribution and publications, which, because he got the order from his spiritual master that if you ever have any money, print books. And Prabhupada knew that, as he said, that these will be the law books for 10,000 years, because things will change, people will come and go, but the basis, the constancy of this of the philosophy will be through the books. That will be the barometer, that will be the guiding force for all times to come. So there is, if there are any rectifications, any difficulties, centuries from now, the guidelines will be against the books. So he made that his major push, and you know, he constantly glorified and appreciated devotees who were, as we've seen in the marathon, and he really got energized when he saw that, because that was the means by which people would spread it further to the masses. Then allowing women and staying in the temple was a really revolutionary thing. Because at that time, there was hardly any congregation. They were mainly either they were brahmacharis or brahmacharinis. And if they got married, they were also full-time devotees. So allowing them to stay in the temple was a very radical step. But he, out of his compassion, and he also knew that if it had to spread, it will have to be as a family unit, that it could then capture the larger groups of people, both in the West as well as in India. Initiating Westerners in the Gaudiya mission was also unique. He performed marriages, which he personally performed marriages of devotees in the beginning. He encouraged them to marry, because he came to a place where the boys and girls were staying together without marrying. I mean, they came from that kind of culture. And he, above everything else, he wanted them to remain in Krishna consciousness, not to give that up. and he encouraged them to marry, and he personally performed marriages, which generally sannyasis don't do. And certainly a person in his position and his shortage of time and his world vision, this was something which he need not have done. But that was the intimacy he developed also, and that was the importance he emphasized in the minds, that it is a sacred, grihastha ashram is also a sacred duty, which if they do intend to get married, then they can also use that to further their Krishna consciousness. Then he introduced the Sunday love feast, as he called it, the Sunday feast program. This has now become a regular staple of every temple, all the temples. There is no temple which doesn't have a Sunday program. Just like a Bhagavatam class, similarly the afternoon, sometimes it's in the afternoon, sometimes in mid-morning, sometimes in the evening, but it's all on Sunday. And the idea again is that Sunday is an easier day for everyone to come and having a nice feast, so that people, you know, by the thousands or tens of thousands sometimes could come there. And everywhere you go now, you know, you may find in the weekdays very few people coming there, but on Sundays, that's the time when they congregate. But gradually then that one way, even if it starts on Sundays, slowly then Krishna enters, you know, into the into your life, coming through one day at a time, one day in a week. Then prasadam distribution, he knew the importance of prasad. And in fact, most devotees in the beginning didn't understand the philosophy properly or didn't understand his accent, but they were attracted by the prasad, and he personally cooked, and he would encourage them to have more and more. So from that time on, he knew that, you know, bhoga offered to the Lord and then distributed really brought, it was a time bomb, that it would bring transformation sooner or later in the lives of devotees. Then even in his preaching, the aggressively attacking the scientists was you could see that he had the pulse of the whole, the way the world was. Now we may say it, that how we can see how the world is practically influenced or completely under the, you know, anyone who brings in any scientific, some kind of technological gadget or so, you know, is really suddenly worshipped. But he could see that, he could foresee in the late 60s itself that people were surrendered to the scientists' thinking. So he started right from the time when His Holiness Bhakti Swarup Damodar Maharaj and the famous conversation with Dr. Singh, as he was then, was really to bring this part, this aspect out. And then even in the importance of the Guru, it didn't really dawn on people. I mean, he himself was the Acharya, but he was so detached from, he saw his position only as a servant of his Guru. But to emphasize the importance, you know, he brought in the concept of a large Vyasasan, which was never heard of. And I think probably most of us would have never even have understood what it was. At least I never knew anything like this existed till, you know, a special Vyasasan for a living person, till we saw, and then we understood the importance of the Guru, and then the Guru Puja, and the emphasis he gave that it should be sung every single day. So this was again his unique stamp, and he had this unique ability or amazing way of bringing the East and the West. The East, the spiritual acumen that the East had, the spiritual essence, and how the Westerners could bring the money, and you know, all the temples that were actually built in the beginning were primarily financed, the Vrindavan, Mayapur and Juhu. Most of the money came from book distribution and some of the projects like selling incense and other things in the West. And Prabhupada would say that, you know, you have been trained that way, you are born in the West, you have this kind of mentality, and you have a background, you are more in the mode of passion, you have been having that kind of training in school and in your education systems. So you can put it to use in Krishna consciousness in such a way that you can help. And that's how we tend to forget that some of the pillars of our own spiritual institutions have actually been financed from the West. And then Indian temples came about much later. So primarily how he could engage those who, whatever propensities they had in their own ways. So in all these ways, these are just some of the illustrations of Srila Prabhupada, and we can appreciate that how we could try to follow his path. And most important, his key instruction, to which he said in repeatedly and also at the end, that you know, you can show your love for me by how you cooperate, because that cooperation is really that, because that is the atmosphere, what environment that is needed to be created, in which this Krishna consciousness can flourish. And that's actually what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also did, that when he by congregation chanting, he brought in a harmony, you know, an atmosphere which was so wonderful, so beautiful, that it only brought the goodness of everyone, and also brought the goodness, but they could appreciate the goodness of others. And glorifying devotees was one way of, was the best way and the only way of actually controlling the tendency to criticize. So exactly like Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj, his divine grace Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj would do, that when he saw devotees quarreling or having problems, arguing with each other, he would call both of them together and make them sit in front of him, and then tell one that, now I want you to hear, in my presence I want you to speak about the glories of this other devotee. So that devotee would have to use all his intelligence to find some good points about the other person. And then eventually he would start, and he would bring up, and then he would keep on saying more. And then if they start looking, then you will find many qualities. And then he would ask the other devotee to say the same. So he was emphasizing the critical need of appreciating and glorifying, such that that would bring out the best in them as well as in the others. And this is really the essence also of what Prabhupada said, that we should cooperate. And also, if you see the Lord Brahma's appreciation for the exalted devotees, that will come naturally to us if we can develop this, if we can curb the tendency to criticize and develop the, and start appreciating the lowest among the devotees. Not just, it's easy to appreciate Prabhupada or Guru Maharaj or great sannyasis and other great leaders, okay, or the acharyas. But actually, how we can appreciate the lowest of the devotees, or anyone who is even starting or struggling, is the way we actually will win the hearts of Lord Krishna and our spiritual master. Hare Krishna. Any questions? So, Granth Raj Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai.